This week on the Best of Flashpoints, two eyewitness accounts from environmental activists on the Gulf Gusher, and an on-the-scene report from the historic Port of Oakland Action that blocked an Israeli ship from being unloaded. Stay tuned.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news report. And we continue our focus on the Gulf. Believe it or not, the federal judge down south has denied determined that offshore oil drilling can continue. The judge has undermined what was a rather mild action by the Obama administration to have a moratorium on all new drilling until there was more investigation. Imagine they might want to know a little bit more about how to stop one of these underground volcano gushers before they keep drilling. It is an amazing and troubling situation. We continue our reporting on the situation in the Gulf, the dismal situation where Mother Nature is bleeding from below, and we could all end up drowning in this loss and sorrow. Joining us again is Elizabeth Cook. She's a Louisiana native, an environmental activist, and she's watching the oil flow. Elizabeth Cook, welcome to Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's very good of you to join us. Yesterday we had on a commander from the Coast Guard, and he, I have to say, painted a rather rosy picture of all the successes in saving animals, the ability to now do more cleanup with thousands of folk on the front line. But maybe you could start as a native, as somebody who's been on the front lines here, what are some of the images that stay with you as you think about what we've seen so far and as the millions of gallons continue to pour into the Gulf?
Well, I guess the image most striking to me right now is our Gulf emergency summit that we held Saturday, this past Saturday, and a woman from Venice, Louisiana, testified, and she was allowed behind enemy lines, so to speak, and allowed to attend one of the morning conferences that BP holds with all of the other agencies involved in the cleanup, including the Coast Guard. And at one of these meetings, a BP official announced that it was time to cut costs. And I think that more than anything to me illustrates the kind of response that we are enduring down here. It is one that is contained by cost. And BP is determining how much they want to spend on the response, and we're not getting much more than that.
So in real terms now, what are some of the grave concerns you have based on where the oil is and what isn't being done? What are some of the...
Well, I mean, it continues to gush out. Supposedly by the end of the month, they'll have 90% contained. But our question is, why couldn't they aim for 90% containment right away instead of waiting weeks and weeks to go by? The oil has poured into various areas of the marsh. We know that there's a massive fish and wildlife die-off going on. I've heard eyewitness accounts of hundreds of fish floating on the surface of the water, of dead small minnows that hug the coast along Alabama, Mississippi, and Florida are dying off. Dolphins, there was one dead whale that was found. We've heard horrific eyewitness accounts of all kinds of sea creatures dying. So we know there's a massive die-off where the oil and dispersant is. And we know that people are getting sick who are working to clean up the oil. And we know that fishermen who are still out fishing in areas that aren't yet closed are getting sick because we believe, and they believe, because of the airborne dispersants.
because of the airborne dispersants. Mm-hmm. Now, when you're saying getting sick, what do you mean? How are people getting sick? What kinds of illness seems to be consistent in a pattern?
Upper respiratory issues, dizziness, nausea, headaches. Those are some of the symptoms I've read about, and I know we've all experienced some of that when we smell the oil burning. We've smelled it as far north as Baton Rouge. One friend of mine told me who lives there. I live in New Orleans, and I've definitely smelled it, and I've definitely felt ill from smelling it. So it's a pretty serious situation down here. I mean, what we have is the toxic oil, and then we have the toxic dispersants applied on top of the toxic oil. So it's adding insult to injury as far as we're concerned. And we want and we are demanding that the federal government stop allowing the use of the dispersants.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're talking about the expanding. Yeah, it's still expanding in a major way every day. We're talking to a Louisiana native, an environmental activist named Elizabeth Cook, who has been working with a number of different groups. And in terms of people getting sick, as I said, we had a commander from the Coast Guard on yesterday, and I asked him about some of the reports that I've been reading, some of the friends, my colleagues down there, in which people who wanted to work on the water, who wanted to help, wanted to get hired, were actually told not to use their protective outfits. And BP was not providing outfits. The commander said the only problem with outfits is they wanted to make sure that people had enough time because it's very hot down there, 90, 100 degrees, and you can't wear those uniforms too long. And so they were looking out for the people's best interest.
Yeah, that's what we heard. And we've also heard that, you know, they feel that they aren't trained properly to wear the protective gear. We've heard all kind of ridiculous statements. The bottom line is they haven't done what they should be doing. And as far as I know, required by federal law to protect workers, and that's to wear respirators. Then we wonder where OSHA is in all this. We wonder, where is the EPA, where is the federal government to ensure the safety of workers? It is a huge issue here. Not only that, workers have been gagged from speaking. They can't speak to the press.
Now, how do you know that? Have you spoken to these workers?
No. Well, actually, a group of us went down there and did. Not all of them are gagging themselves. Some are speaking. But there was a WDSU report, that's a local TV report, that, you know, they went down there to try to interview workers, and workers under no circumstance, you know, flat out told them, we can't speak to you. And that's it. And there's been multiple reports of workers being gagged. And of course, BP denies this, but the bottom line is they can't speak, or they may lose their job. That's what we're hearing over and over.
They can't speak, or they may lose their job. And if they don't follow orders in terms of not wearing outfits when they're told not to wear them, they can lose their job. Now, I'm not sure what information is real. I've been following this at a lot of different levels, and mm-hmm. I've been following the discussion among oil men and oil experts. And there's Wild Matt Simmons, who knows a lot about oil, was a heavy investor in oil, independent now, has been talking on some of the economic shows, major networks, about this could be a reservoir of between 1.5, 2 billion gallons. And if things don't go right, like the fact that they already believe, the oilmen believe, that there's already a second leak that's even larger than the first, which might help to explain the amazing expansion in estimates. We're now up to considering 100,000 barrels a day. I don't know how many million gallons that is, but it's a lot. What are people thinking in terms of the estimates and the amount of oil that's coming up now?
Well, we're all trying to follow the estimates as they go up and up, and that's exactly what they've done for weeks now, and finally we're at the internal BP memo worst-case scenario of 100,000 barrels, which hasn't been officially confirmed, but that was the memo that was leaked.
And that came out from Congressman Markey's office, I believe.
Right. And here's the deal. This is such a closed response process that is going on here. There's no transparency. So it has been very difficult to get any information. Why is it that we still don't have confirmation of whether there are any leaks down below? Who is controlling the flow of information? Why isn't that being discussed openly? If we can film the flow that's going on now, why can't we film the leaks if there are indeed leaks? So, you know, you have to ask these questions. Who is controlling the flow of information? And as far as we can see, BP is being allowed still to control the flow of information.
Now, you talked about it always being about the bottom line in terms of finances. And in BP's 600-page response report, on the second page, they say one of the most important things is to know how big the leak is or leaks are or Gusha is so that they know how to prepare. And yet, it does seem that the idea was not to know, to keep people in the dark, to use dispersants, mm-hmm. which were so toxic and dangerous, to spread out the oil so it could not be evaluated, estimated, and thus people wouldn't have a clear idea of what the legal responsibility would be.
Yeah, I agree with you. That we feel that's exactly what's happened. The dispersant was used to push the oil to keep it beneath the surface where it could be less successfully evaluated in terms of the amount of flow. Also, there was supposedly some sort of trade-off made that perhaps it is less harmful to the environment to push the oil beneath the surface than to have it come ashore. But as we've said and many are saying, including Billy Nungesser down in Plaquemines Parish, if you would allow the oil to come to the surface, we could see the enemy, we could fight the enemy, we could collect the oil. But by pushing it beneath the surface, it's, for example, sneaking into the marsh under the surface of the water, underneath the booms. The use of dispersant renders the booms just a big joke. It's like the booms are nothing more than PR right now because they're totally ineffective to keep the oil out of the marsh.
So the marshes are thoroughly...
No, I wouldn't say thoroughly. They are becoming contaminated. I mean, local officials have done what they can do, you know, working around the BP stranglehold on the response here. Locals are using barges to block the flow of oil. They're using rocks. They're using artificial sand barriers, sandbags. They're building artificial sand berms. They're hard at work trying to protect the marsh, but a lot of the effort came after weeks and weeks of wrangling with BP and Coast Guard and going back and forth and trying to figure out who's actually in control down here, because there doesn't seem to be any sort of decision-making structure that folks can easily identify.
And you said you talked to some of the workers, you went down, and actually everybody wasn't gagged. What more might we not know here in the Bay Area or people listening across the country? What's the information that you want more of us to know?
Well, the dispersant they're using, Core Exit, has never been used in these massive quantities before, that they're using the Gulf of Mexico essentially as a laboratory, and BP and the federal government are dishing out millions of dollars to now study the effects of the dispersants. Well, frankly, we don't want any studies. We want it to stop. We want to stop the use of the dispersant. And the studies aren't going to help. You know, the toxicity of the dispersant, we believe, is adding to the massive fish and wildlife die-off that is occurring even as we speak. They're not showing the horrific images anymore on national television as though folks have moved on, but there are some terrible images coming out of the Gulf that we're seeing, just, as I said, hundreds of fish on the surface, manta rays, whole schools of manta rays dying in front of people's eyes that are, you know, out in boats trying to see what's going on, just horrific sights of wildlife and fish dying off and dead and floating. And we want people to know that this is a terrible environmental catastrophe. We want the entire country and the world to feel the urgency that we need assistance to get the oil out of the water. We wonder, why haven't the tankers been brought in? The massive tankers that were used in the Persian Gulf during a massive oil spill, you know, many years ago. They modified tankers to skim the oil out of the water. Where are the tankers? You know, where is the help that was turned down, you know, in foreign countries? Eugene Robinson, the columnist, wrote about this last week, that the U.S. has spurned several offers from foreign countries to send gigantic skimmers. We want to know why this is happening. You know, we feel as though we're being denied the resources we need to deal with this terrible spill, and we want to know why, and we want it addressed immediately, because this is an emergency down here.
And this is the Gulf of Mexico. This is other countries. This is Cuba, which is totally unprepared to take an onslaught. This is coming into the Florida Keys now. People are still saying, well, it's okay to swim as long as you don't see the oil, but you can't see the dispersant either.
Right.
And then they're worried about this catching the loop, and then there it goes out into the Atlantic and hello, Europe.
Yes. I mean, the ramifications could be far-reaching, but people are not being adequately protected now. I don't think that resources have been brought to bear that could have been brought to bear on this. Why hasn't a national emergency or national disaster been declared down here? Marshaling all available resources, including foreign resources. Instead, it's been left to the very corporation that caused this to begin with. And this is a crime on top of a crime.
And I guess if it's hurricane season, one wonders where a hurricane sweeps its water from.
Yeah, there have been varying debates about what could happen if a hurricane would come in the Gulf. And in fact, there may be a storm in the Gulf next week, we understand. There's a 50-50 chance of that, but some scientists say it would help disperse the oil. Others say it could bring it further inland.
We could have an oily rain.
Yes, either way, it could. I mean, we just don't need a hurricane right now. That's right. For sure, and we're all praying we don't get one.
All right, finally, I know that you were part of a gathering, a major meeting to try and have a collaboration at the grassroots level to try
Absolutely.
And make things happen. Tell me and our audience about that.
Well, we brought in folks from all over the country, scientists, ordinary folks, just anyone who wants to come and help, basically. We had a major meeting yesterday, and we are continuing our efforts. I'm sorry, the meeting was on Saturday. Now, yesterday, we went down to the Deepwater Horizon Joint Incident Command headquarters in downtown New Orleans, and several of us went up to the 14th floor where their headquarters are and presented a list of demands and were promptly escorted out by security. But
did they accept your list?
They did. They accepted some of the list. I think essentially we put them on notice that we're just sick and tired of how it's being handled down here. And I hope that coming out of this emergency summit, there's a great deal more organizing and direct action and possibly civil disobedience, because that's exactly what's needed to bring this situation to the country and show that there are folks who are resisting here we just need a whole lot more voices raised all over the country about this horrible catastrophe that's happening to four Gulf states and the ecology of the Gulf, the precious ecology of the Gulf.
Oh, the precious.
Yeah, we want everyone to become involved in some way, to raise your voices, wherever you are, in whatever way you feel you can.
Elizabeth Cook, is there a website you'd recommend?
Sure. We set up a website, gulfemergencysummit.org. The name of the website may be changing, but at least if you have that, you'll be able to find it.
Gulfemergency.org.
GulfEmergencySummit.org, and we will be having links to events and press releases and any other information and documents that we share with the world.
All right. Well, we want to thank you very much for taking the time out, Elizabeth Cook, Louisiana native, environmental activist on the front line, trying to stand and fight this disaster. And, we are all in jeopardy. The world is bleeding. It's a volcano. They opened up a wound. They don't know how to deal with it. And we probably don't know the full extent or can't even imagine how bad it could be. We thank you for being with us, and you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We continue with our coverage on the Gulf and the continuing Gusha, and the news is all bad. We're going to start with Florida. This just coming off the wires, Florida saw its worst impact yet from the BP oil spill as thick oily sludge washed ashore on Pensacola Beach on Wednesday, and emergency workers found an oil-covered dolphin stranded on the shore. State emergency workers said the pudding-like mixture covered 3 miles of Pensacola Beach, a barrier island that is part of the Gulf Islands National Seashore. Quoting now fishermen, it's just a line of black all the way down the beach as far as you could see in both directions. It's ruined. And the governor toured the beach. He said, we've seen tar barrels, but never this kind of stuff. And it is looking as it's becoming a worst case scenario. We're going to go to Florida. We're really delighted and happy to be joined by Sydney Lepore. She's been an environmentalist, a native of Florida, working for weeks now. Sydney Lepore, the situation has now gotten a lot worse. I guess many people aren't surprised because long slicks have been hovering offshore. Tell us exactly where you are and some of the things that you've been seeing in the last day or so.
Okay. I have a house on the dock at what's called Kid Point, right inside the pass at Fort Walton Beach. And for several weeks, I've been watching different things come in across my dock, none of which really looked like oil, but actually it was. We've had slicks here off and on. I've spent the last 2 weeks in Orange Beach, Alabama, trying to save and protect 200 dolphins and see what could be done there with oil coming in Mobile Bay and oil coming in Perdido Key. Some of the things that I have experienced myself with my own eyes is we went through, a lot of times you can't see it if you're not, if the light's not right. So we went through an oil pool right at dusk when we were out looking for the dolphins and make sure that they were making sure that they were all right. And as soon as we hit this, it was like you had cut our air off. We couldn't breathe. We couldn't speak. We were all throwing up over the side, and we were all very experienced boat people, one of which is a diesel mechanic. Now, this is inside the pass at what's called Arnica Bay. Okay, right by St. John's Bay in Alabama. And my hopes in going there was to learn what they were doing in order to save their dolphins and their back bays and their nurseries in order to provide safety and education for the people here in Florida, since I'm living here in Fort Walton Beach. And it was an education, to say the least.
Tell us with some detail what you saw. Did you see wounded dolphins? What was the situation like? Well, give us the details.
Well, we were trying to keep an eye on the dolphins. This is a very special dolphin pod. It's called the Friendly Dolphin Pod. They've lived there for as long as anybody can remember. Essentially, they were trapped in between Mobile Bay and Perdido, which has both been heavily oiled now. We saw they would come in and spray dispersants about 6 hours before the oil would come in, and then we ended up doing bird rescues because birds would be falling out of the nest and baby birds would be in danger. We ended up watching the dolphins very carefully because one day they would be the lethargic. We watched the fish populations go down in the back bay. The next day they would be giddy, acting, which, as we found out, corexant, that is symptoms of corexant, and dolphins don't have a sense of smell. As a matter of fact, after you hit this gas, which I smelled it in the bar before I ever left for Orange Beach one time, and it took me about 3 hours to get over the coffin.
Are a lot of people getting sick?
The CDC says the waters are okay, but you can pick up the water and it smells like gasoline. There's tar balls on the beach and kids playing in the sand and people swimming in it. They closed a small area of fisheries right at Pensacola, but the federal waters have closed everything 5 miles off. We've been watching on the maps this oil coming in for weeks and providing suggestions on how to keep it out of the bay so that we have something to replenish the bays after it's all over. It's such a pinball panic, it's not even funny. I have myself watched booms in the middle of the dolphin nurseries that have stayed there 3 weeks. At this point, they are leaching oil back into the water, and birds are standing on them. I mean, I've cleaned up oil spills in boat ramps myself in the hot sun because the response time was so slow and everybody's so overwhelmed. We sat there in the middle of the bay at St. John's Bay and watched BP boats circling in a very, very heavy oil slick, the dolphins, and nobody did a thing. And the dolphins can't smell, so they were in distress and hiding underneath the oil. And at that point, if you don't do something, it's actually neglect. So it's been amazing to watch the whole thing. This oil slick that came in at Pensacola Beach, when I saw it on the news, I actually just sat down and cried because you know, they're not even protecting the passes in the back bays. And if they protect the passes in the back bays, they've still got places for tourists to come. You know, there's not much we can do about the Gulf, but there's a lot we can do about the back bays and protecting the dolphins and wildlife back here. There's no air monitors. There's no mask. We can't get accurate information about the water, whether it's safe to go in and whether it's not. The health department tells us that, well, you can go in the water, but don't get it in your eyes, don't get it in your mouth, don't get it in your ears, don't get it up your nose, you know. And they really don't have any earthly idea what the long-term effects of this stuff is going to be.
Wow. You're listening.
So we are extremely concerned. We're mad. We're frustrated. We're trying to implement, I mean, the time for planning at this point is over. Do something, even if it's wrong. The booms don't work. A good jet ski can wash right over the booms. You know, if you've got any kind of sea at all, the booms are useless. And it's almost beyond words. I mean, can you tell me of another company or another person in the whole world that collects their own evidence against themselves? You know, it's ridiculous.
So let's talk a little bit more about BP. Let me let people know you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Cindy Lepore. She is based in Florida. She was in Alabama. She was working with the dolphins there. There are reports now, and there are firsthand reports that Pensacola Beach is covered with this heavy, thick, oily sludge, pudding-like mixture covered 3 miles at least of Pensacola Beach. There doesn't seem to be much in the way of progress by BP. Now, we were assured by a Coast Guard commander working at the command center a couple of days ago that things were getting better, that BP had thousands of boats on the water, that they were looking out for our safety, and the cleanup seemed to be going, according to this commander, apace. So your response to that from the Coast Guard?
How'd that work for you? Go look at the beaches. You know, I've sat there and I've watched. We actually studied out the BP boats and how they worked and what kind of things they were doing on the beach to clean it up and all of that kind of stuff. You know, their hands are so tied by OSHA, it's ridiculous. And I realized that, you know, there's safety to be done. It's hot out here, you know, all of that stuff. And we've had like three workers to die from the heat.
You said three workers?
Yeah, three workers have actually died from the heat down here.
Because they were wearing the suits or?
Right. They were wearing the suits. I mean, how can you have hazmat workers cleaning up oil and people swimming in the water and sunbathing within 10 feet of each other?
Really?
That doesn't make any sense.
There are people swimming right around the area where the hazmat people are dressed and cleaning.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They took our shoes off the other day and decontaminated them. You know, and yet they say this stuff won't hurt us. I mean, somebody's not telling the truth here.
Now, do you find, we've heard reports, and we keep trying to confirm them, that workers were told to keep it silent, or
I've
they won't be...
I've actually got a copy of that.
You do? You have a copy
of
it?
Yeah, there is a gag order. A friend of mine has a copy of it, and that has been actually released to some of the media.
Have you spoken to any of the workers? Have they all been gagged, or are people, some people willing to speak?
Well, you know, all the fishermen cry at the bar after it's all over with. And I heard this morning that one of the workers, one of the captains on the boat, said it was so bad that he came in and committed suicide this morning.
Who committed suicide?
One of the captains that was working for BP.
Now, we had reports. That's horrible. We're going to try and confirm that. And let's see if we can get a name and find out what happened.
I don't have a name right now.
Okay.
I just talked to another captain in Orange Beach this morning, but I will get the name.
Okay.
I don't have an issue with that.
We definitely want to follow up on that because it does. It's an indication of how terribly things are going.
At some of the protests that I've actually been to, the boat captains, people would come by and slip us things. Like one captain came by and slipped me a bottle, and it looked like coffee. It looked like a Starbucks coffee thing. And he said, look at the top. And I could see the oil floating on the top. And he said, honey, that's what's coming. He said, you can't even imagine. And I had another guy that came up to me and handed me a baby food jar that looked like red latex paint. And he said, that's what's behind what the other captain gave you. I mean, they're obviously, you know, they don't want to lose their jobs. That's the only income they have right now. And but they want to get the word out, too. They're very worried and very upset. And we've heard all kinds of rumors here about, I think on the internet there was the shrimpers are coming and cleaning up all the oil, and then they're putting them in, a boat captain working on the oil spill response died from a gunshot wound this morning.
That's William
Allen Carse, born 1955.
And
that's who it was. He was captain of the Rookie.
And it's K-R-U-S-E, correct?
K-R-U-S-E.
William Allen, he committed suicide. He's a captain, came in. And
this
who
morning,
told you that?
One of my friends in Orange Beach.
I see.
I'm actually reading it in a news bulletin right now.
And I think the L.A. Times is also reporting it. It's obviously
a
done deal.
We pretty much know what's going down here. And it ain't pretty.
Well, tell us a little bit more, because we're not hearing about it up here in the Bay Area and across the country. Say a little bit more.
Okay. There'll be BP boats running everywhere. They go in at 8. They leave at 5. They take their breaks. They take their lunches. They were all coming into the marinas at one time. There wouldn't be anybody out there cleaning up any oil anywhere during certain hours, because you could tell when it was lunchtime. We were out there on a boat. I've actually got films and pictures of most of this stuff. They tell us they're not spraying dispersants anymore, but when you turn the water up, it foams like soap. They say that they're not spraying dispersants, they're spraying detergents. That's their latest line. But it's funny how those detergents seem to take your breath away. They're burning oil offshore. You can see the smoke. You can smell it. Anything that gets caught up in these oil booms doesn't make it out. And from what I hear, sometimes there's animals in there. Just around here, you can see them. They have different stations. It's usually a 24-hour response time to get anything done at all.
Let me stop you there for a moment. In terms of the burning of the animals, we've had now several troubling reports about turtles, some of the endangered species actually going up in these fires. Can you confirm that? What do you know about the actual burning of the animals?
Well, they take shrimp nets. Do you know what a shrimp net is?
Describe it for us.
Okay, it's a big, huge net that hangs on a pole, and it's kind of fine, and it scoops up everything in its path, including the shrimp, and then they take the shrimp, they put it on the back of the boat, they sort it all out. Okay, they got little stools, and they throw everything back that they don't want in there. There's supposed to be a turtle save catch thing on each shrimp net, but they're using these nets to gather up the oil, okay? And then they take all everything that was gathered up in with the oil, which... Now, you have to think about, this doesn't look like oil. This looks like red, thick latex paint, okay? They gather it all up in a boom, and they burn it. That's common knowledge, okay? They never say anything about the animals, but if it's in a shrimp net, the animals are there, too. That's just logic. There was a report on the Internet from a boat captain. I think it's seaturtle.org. where the boat captain is actually on there saying that they aren't doing turtle rescues anymore because BP won't let them inside the booms to save the turtles. It's very obvious that the dolphins, there's an effect on them. When we went through that oil spill where we couldn't breathe, about 24 hours later, I got dizzy, and everybody else got dizzy on the boat. I'm still a bit dizzy from it. I still have shortness of breath. The workers on the boats do not have air masks on to protect them. I don't know if it would protect them anyway. You know, I don't know if it's even practical to put air masks on with the amount of heat that's going on down here. You know, so they've got some real problems and concerns down here. But there's no air monitoring here either. That I really get concerned about, because if you're in a car and you get a whiff of something coming off of the Gulf and it takes your breath for 3 hours. I mean, there's reports of kids with asthma and respiratory problems. People are literally falling apart down here just from the stress, not to mention what's coming off the Gulf.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with a resident down not too far from Pensacola, watching the oil flooding in. Our guest, Sydney Lepore, was in Alabama trying to work with the people there, desperately trying to save dolphins and other sea life. The situation is obviously getting worse all the time, and it is very troubling now. The Coast Guard is reporting that BP has been forced to remove a cap that was containing some of the oil gushing rushing into the Gulf. That's according to Thad, Coast Guard Admiral Thad Allen says an underwater robot bumped into a venting system that sent gas rising through the vent that carries warm water down to prevent ice-like crystals from forming. There's a grave concern. This is a lot more oil gushing into the Gulf. There's a concern that there are other leaks along the pipe, that the leaks are a lot worse than people ever imagined, this gusher. And we're also hearing concerns, and I don't know if you're hearing this, Sydney, as well, about a possible gas explosion. And people are describing just what the scenario now that's coming out of the Gulf being confirmed by the Coast Guard, that there could be a massive explosion here.
There's absolutely the possibility of a massive explosion. I grew up in the oil field. All wells explode. When they have more coming out, there's also something else that nobody seems to be thinking about is when you release that much pressure that quickly on the St. Andreas Fault, which is a salt dome, which is right underneath the oil well, and you've released that much pressure that quickly, there is a really good high chance of having earthquakes.
And that means underwater, that's a tsunami, and there are other reports. There's a lot of information surfacing today in terms of the expanded dangers.
Well, I said that 2 weeks ago. I'm glad they caught up.
They caught up with you, but you're there on the front line. Before we say goodbye to you, your final concerns. I know you're back in your place. You're near the beach at the coast in Florida. The oil is slushing on in now, and whatever that other stuff is coming in. What are your concerns now? I guess there's a growing anger in your community.
Absolutely. There's anger. There's frustration. This is day 65, right? I mean, looks like we would have had some kind of plan in place by now, you know, but everybody thinks if it's not in their front door, then they don't have to worry about it. Well, guess what? It's here. And it's been here for about 3 weeks. We just didn't know it yet. My greatest concern right now is for the dolphins. I don't think they make hazmat suits for dolphins, and they're in it 24/7, and they're in trouble. And my other greatest concern at this moment is human health, because they're eating the fish. Nobody tells the fish where to swim. There is oil in the water. And the children and the breathing in the air. I honestly do not think they will have to evacuate us. If we can't breathe, we can't stay. And I have got firsthand knowledge of what it's like to be in the middle of these heavy oil fumes. And if it had been more than 10 minutes, we would have been in serious trouble. You have to get away from it when it happens. So there's a lot of concerns right now. And I can't worry about a tsunami or the oil well exploding. Take care of that when it happens. Right now, our immediate concern is the fishing, the health, and saving the back bays so that after all is said and done, oh, by the way, did you know that they told the people down here that we can't build sand berms to protect our back bays? They did that today. You know, they're tying our hands. They're making us where we can't even fix it ourselves. If we do something, it's against the law, and somebody needs to be in charge besides BP.
All right. Well, we're going to stay with this. We hope we can check back with you, Sydney Lepore, and continue to get your frontline reports, because you're there, you're witnessing it firsthand, and we need to hear it.
I'm actually making photographs. I'm recording all that I'm seeing, because I think someday that this is going to be very important, that so we don't make these mistakes in the future.
All right. We're going to be back to you in the very near future. Thanks for being with us, and we wish you the best of luck. Our heart goes out to you.
For Flashpoints in Berkeley, I'm Jesse Strauss. Yesterday, humanitarian activists gathered at the Port of Oakland to support the local longshoremen's union in divesting from offloading an Israeli cargo ship. The union did not cross the picket line set up by an estimated 800 to 1,000 dedicated activists, who arrived bright and early at 5:30 a.m. on Father's Day. The activists were made up of people from all walks of life, from moms pushing strollers to older union activists pushing walkers. At the end of the day, organizers celebrated the shutting down of Berth 58 of the Port of Oakland for 24 hours in the first historic port divestment from apartheid Israel in the United States. Our special correspondent Nora Barrows Friedman was at that action, and she offered us a series of interviews with ILW union members and activists present at yesterday's action. This is what they had to say.
My name is Munad Al-Hirzalla. I am from Arab American Union Members Council. I'm part of the labor community committee that have mobilized for this action.
Tell us about the history of this action, how you know you chose to target this one specific day, this one specific ship.
Well, this specific location is a historical location where members of ILWU, that's International Longshoremen and Warehouse Union, are well known about their courageous militant positions towards fighting against injustice. They have done that back in the in 1984, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I believe they did do that in, during the 30s to stop the World War II. And so they have been courageous, and they stood in principles in supporting different issues. And today, the same locations we are, the San Francisco Labor Council, Alameda Central Labor Council, dozens and dozens of other unions have responded to a call by the Palestine General Federation unions for doing something and blocking the ships that load and unload to Israel, to make a statement that saying after the flotilla incident, there is no way that business can conduct, Israel can conduct their business as usual. So, and they cannot be above the law. They need to be hold accountable to what they did. I think having this type of action at this political moment in the United States of America, that is the sole supporter of this injustice being done by Israel, is quite significant.
And Manadal, talk about the kind of people that are here and the message that you're trying to send to the ILW workers who are trying to come to work this morning.
Well, we are hopeful that with the coalition that we have, where dozens of union members and dozens of other organizations, community organizations, are part of this action, and the tradition of the ILWU not to cross the picket line is very clear. Therefore, we anticipate our brothers and sisters in the ILWU to do what they usually do. And we honor this, and we feel this is the type of solidarity that the Palestinian need and the Palestinian deserves. And everybody who have sacrificed their life, including but not limited to the meritors who were killed in flotilla.
My name is Clarence Thomas. I'm an ILWU Local 10 member and a lineman. So we tie up ships when they come into port and let them go. And this is going to be a very, very important historic day, I believe. And that's why people are out here today.
Thank you. What are some of the workers in the union saying about today's action and kind of in the context of the political history of the ILWU?
Well, I want to be very clear. I think that when we compare what's happening today to what happened in 1984, there was some 7 years of political education that had happened with our members, because the first action that took place was in 1977, Pier 27 in San Francisco on an Easter Sunday, where some 5,000 people turned out to oppose the working of a ship. In this instance, our members have not had the kind of political education around the issue, but this is going to raise the stakes, because as I said before, the AFL-CIO, the San Francisco Labor Council, and the Central Labor Council of Alameda County have adopted resolutions that are supporting this picket line to oppose what happened on international waters regarding the attack on the flotilla. So I think that's significant. So this is a teaching moment, but I don't want to give the impression that our members are as well versed on the subject as they were with the issue concerning the anti-apartheid movement, because, you know, workers have to be educated. But contractually, when we come out here to go to work today, this picket line raises the question of health and safety. We don't want to create a situation where people have deep sentiments regarding this issue, and we don't want our members to be in any way put in the middle. You may recall that in April of 2003, when the police attacked not only the people who were demonstrating, but also the longshoremen who were standing by, that's an indication of the question of health and safety. The police can't make it safe for us to cross this picket line, and I think that everybody needs to understand that. And so we hope that we don't have a repeat of what happened in 2003. That's what we don't want to happen. So right now, the police seem to be restrained. Their presence is not that strong. I do understand that the organizers did meet with the Oakland Police Department. They have expressed that there's new leadership, and I understand that they were very impressed with the organizers in terms of how they have put this thing together. So I think that that's a step in the right direction. Maybe they've learned something from what happened in April of 2003. Let's hope so.
Okay, yeah, Tishawi, could you tell us about the significance of today's action?
Well, we see today as a very historic event because it's going to set the precedent for any union who wants to boycott the state of Israel to actually take action. They're going to follow suit after the courageous International Longshore Workers Union, who have taken a very courageous step in honoring our picket line. We've got hundreds of people over here. They've showed up at 5:30 a.m. There's a lot of dedication. This is a very spirited picket. And a lot of workers have come up. Some of them have expressed their support, and others have just simply honored the picket line and walked off. So we feel very encouraged about the historical significance of this event.
And if the ship is not unloaded today, what happens next?
Our objective is to block this ship and this employer that's trading with apartheid goods for 24 hours. That's our objective. And so this morning, for the first 12 hours, we've already been successful, and we're working on the next 12 hours.
And there's arbitration happening now. Can you tell us what that means and what's going on?
Well, the arbitrators came out and saw the picket lines, and they wanted to make sure that this picket line is real and that it represents a health and safety threat to their workers. And so once the arbitrator rules, we can determine how long this protest is going to go on, for the morning at least. But we're definitely going to be back here in the afternoon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My name is Kathy Sheets. I live in Richmond, and I'm here to support this wonderful outpouring of people that are here to stop the unloading of an Israeli ship. And this is in solidarity with the fact that Israel has been attacking human rights boats. They have been occupying Palestine for way too long, and now they have this tremendous siege on Gaza, which is causing humanitarian crisis in Gaza.
And Kathy, you were on the flotilla. Tell us a little bit about your experience and how that really ties into today.
Okay. Well, I was on the boats. I think it's just important for American presence to be there because there are many, many Americans that would have been on those ships. They're rather hard to get to. But the most important thing is to connect those ships in this country to what our country's responsibility is toward this entire disaster called Palestine and Israel. And the fact that the occupation still is not a household word. People don't really understand that Israel is brutally occupying Palestine and that we're paying for it. And in fact, probably even more than paying for it. I mean, while I was being shot at on a U.S. flagged boat in the international waters, I was being shot at by military equipment from my own country. The guns that came on board were U.S. guns pointing at my head while I had to hand over my weapons, which happened to be cameras and cell phones. That's all they ever asked for. That's all they ever wanted.
And Kathy, just a bizarre twist in the story. You discovered that because your wallet had also been stolen by the Israeli commandos aboard the flotilla. A few days later, you started noticing some charges on your debit cards. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, when we were escorted off the boat at gunpoint again, we weren't allowed to bring anything with us. I had the clothes on my back and I did have my passport. They let me hold my passport until I went to be interrogated. And at that point, they took it away because I refused to sign something that was only in Hebrew. Then I went on to jail, and I did receive my passport back when I left. However, nothing but the clothes on my back came back with me. And then when I got home, I tried to get a ticket to San Francisco, and they said, no, your bank card has been stopped. And at that point in time, I went online and realized that there were about 40 charges. And the charges that didn't go through at all happened to be when they had to use my PIN number. But they did discover that they could buy in particular beer if they used my bank card and they put it in some sort of vending machine. So I have I've treated the Israeli soldiers after they killed all these activists and killed 9 activists, wounded 30. I treated them with beer with my card.
My God, what do you intend to do right now?
I'm still. I'm having a difficulty with that because I'm still not at all concerned about that. I'm still outraged about the deaths. I'm still outraged that I was on a U.S. flagged boat, and the only thing I heard from my government is that Israel had a right to attack those ships in defense. But while the ships were being attacked by Israeli soldiers, apparently none of the activists should have been taking guns away or doing anything to protect the people on board. And again, in U.S. waters, if you are on a U.S. flagged, in international waters, if you're on a U.S. flagged boat, that is U.S. property. And it's up for the U.S. to both be concerned about what's happening with the passengers on the boat and the goods that are on that boat. And so I feel as though I'm now secondary to Israel in every sense of the word. I did call the State Department when I found out my credit cards were used, and their response was, well, I guess you just better call the credit card company. Eventually, they did inquire more, but I think it was more because they received more information about the fact that probably that wasn't the best response. But that's what's sad about it. There was no U.S. presence in terms of U.S. citizens being there doing something that is legal. It's absolutely illegal what we did. And the reason I know that is that 2 years ago, we were allowed in. And Israel did admit at that time that it was legal for us to go into Caesar because they're not supposedly occupying it. Well, of course they are occupying it, but we can't have everything both ways.
Thank you so much, Kathy.
Thank you.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Jesse Strauss, with technical support from Eric Klein. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at flashpoints.net for our archive shows, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/flashpointsnews. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule to dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Thank you for listening.